Welcome to Wild Tater Podcast, Permaculture for the Penniless. I am Charles Hathaway, and today we're continuing on our permaculture design course journey. This time we're going to get a little bit more into some of the instruction, or some of the, you might say, lecture kind of stuff. We've talked about some of the assignments, things to be working on. This is going to provide some of the context for why we're doing what we're doing. First off, let's start with the most basic question. What is permaculture? Now, permaculture is a word that was invented by Bill Mollison, and the whole concept behind permaculture was co-founded, this whole science, if you will, was co-founded by Bill Mollison and David Holmgren. And I'm not going to give you much of their background except to say that Bill Mollison saw, you know, holes in the whole agricultural system and in his own studies of ecosystems and so forth, he saw that what we're doing is just not going to work. It's just not going to hold water, if you will. It's not sustainable. We can't keep doing this forever. And so he thought, is there a way that we can design agriculture and production of food, shelter, of fuel, and all our resources in some way that is genuinely sustainable, that we could keep doing it this way for thousands of years and would be okay? Basically, you know, what can we do? When it comes down to it, it's essentially using what nature does to create what we need in yields of food and so forth, using nature's methods to produce. And the word permaculture is a portmanteau, okay? A portmanteau being a combination of two words, cut the, you know, chunks out of them and stick them together. And permaculture is a portmanteau of the words permanent and agriculture. Now, you'll hear some people, when they talk about permaculture, they'll say it's a cross between permanent and culture because they want to make it so inclusive and so forth. But it started out as intending to just be a form of permanent agriculture, a sustainable agriculture. And it kind of predates a lot of the sustainable agriculture movement that are taking place today, but it is probably the fuel that started that whole movement, it would be my guess. But the idea is to make a permanent agriculture that is both sustainable, that it's friendly to people and to the earth, and also it's intended to be giving back to the earth and to people, and to be able to be maintainable over generations or even centuries. Personally, I think of permaculture as terraforming a landscape. If you're into science fiction at all, it's the idea of, say, going to a planet like Mars and creating an ecosystem there. Now, you know, on that level, on science fiction kind of level, you're usually starting with landscapes that may not even have dirt. You know, they may just be rock or whatever, and so finding a way to be able to support life on that planet is kind of what we're talking about with terraforming. But if you take it down to a more practical level, a more interesting level, in my opinion, you might say that here I live in this desert mountain meadow landscape, and you know, it's like there's no forest here. There's not forest for miles. You know, if you, well, I shouldn't say that. You go a mile and a half up the mountain, and yes, suddenly you're deep in forest. But I'm not in a forest here where I'm at, and yet I want to create a forest. I want to essentially terraform a forest, but not just any forest. I want to make a forest that produces food, that produces fuel, that produces, you know, food for livestock that I can have right here on my property. Have a forest of with creatures and so forth, all of which makes this sort of farm, this sort of agriculture, in this way that's going to look very much like the wild forests up in the mountains, but instead of making the kinds of plants that are there, I want it to grow plants that will provide me and my family food and shelter and materials and resources and so forth. That's what permaculture is about. And among the major focuses of permaculture is, of course, as mentioned, this idea of doing what nature does to create yields. And also, and we'll get into this more, but there's an element of function stacking, which is to say, you know, with traditional agriculture, we line the rows with these plants because this is which way the watering system is lined up to be able to trickle water down this way or to be able to, you know, spray it in this way. Done. You know, we'll have one crop, so much water, done. But in permaculture, you're more looking at the functions of individual things. So what does corn do? Well, it produces a lovely food that we eat, okay? Agriculture goes as far as that, and then to say, well, let's plant them together so that we can have it compact and so forth. And then, you know, and then they kind of stop the functions at that point. But permaculture wants to say, well, what else does corn do? Well, it's a grass, so it fixes nitrogen, it uses nitrogen, it develops nitrogen in its leaves and so forth. Okay, well, if we're going to be needing nitrogen, what if we were to plant some nitrogen-fixing plants around it or among it? You know, things that will put nitrogen into the soil as it's growing. And then if we were to do that, maybe we could even have, you know, once the corn is too tall for chickens to be eating the tops off of it, we could have them be eating the nitrogen plants down below that are feeding the corn, and their feces that they leave behind will help to fertilize the corn and so forth. And you're taking as many functions as possible and putting them all together, and you're designing it in such a way as to get as many functions as possible out of every element in the system. Essentially, you're designing an ecosystem. Okay, so we talked about who founded permaculture a little bit. If I understand right, Bill Mollison had these ideas and he was kind of presenting them as a professor at a college. And David was so taken up by this as a student that he and Bill got together and began to discuss these things in great detail and basically started this whole thing. Bill Mollison, if you want to really dive into permaculture and understand it on, you know, just a ridiculous, you know, like I said, doctorate degree level, I recommend getting the book Permaculture, A Designer's Manual by Bill Mollison. Now, we're talking about $100 to $150 book. It is a textbook, and it's intended to be. It's a reference book, but it's also a book that if you're intending to be a permaculture designer, someone who is consulting or who is designing properties for people, you're going to want to have this book, probably even read it. Because especially if you're planning on going elsewhere outside of your own bioregion to do much of the designing and consulting for, you know, permaculture students and so forth. Anyway, let's go on. So let's talk for a minute about groups of people from an area. Now, I remember several years ago, before I discovered permaculture, I found a book. Being from Utah, I am descended from pioneers, and they had to come to across the plains to Utah, much as the gold diggers in California and the, you know, people of Oregon and so forth, Oregon Trail folk. They came. They packed, you know, as much food as they could, rationed it on the way and so forth, but they were starting from scratch in deserts, on the West Coast, and, you know, particularly in my area, which is Utah, a desert. I mean, a mountain desert, to be sure, but a desert nonetheless. And they were settling these lands and growing crops in them and taking advantage of what was here and so forth. And I found a book by Caleb Warnock, which I recommend. The book is called The Forgotten Skills of Self-Sufficiency Used by the Mormon Pioneers. And when I got this book, I was very curious because, you know, just that concept of what self-sufficient skills did the pioneers have? Because they started from scratch. I mean, if we call it scratch, today they started from real scratch. And you know, what were some of the methods they would use in growing their gardens, in creating crop yields and so forth? What did they do? And in this process, it was kind of an eye-opener to me to think, wow, you know, here we've been wrestling with the question of organic gardening versus you know, traditional gardening and agriculture using sprays and fertilizers and pesticides and all this stuff. And I'm like, I don't want to use any of that stuff. And yet, I don't know much about, you know, I'm not that good of a gardener. And so if I want to have a good yield, how can I do it without fertilizer and pesticides and so forth? And of course, with the organic movement, you can get all kinds of organic fertilizers and organic pesticides. And I'm just like, but that's still expensive. And we're talking about for the penniless here. You know, I'm not I'm not blessed with great money to work with. And so if I can afford seeds at the end of the season when they go $5 for $1 and then plant them the next year, yes, we've lost some viability, but some of them are still going to grow. So I'll take them because I can afford those. You know, that's the kind of thing that I'm dealing with. I can't afford, you know. Anyway, so I thought, well, pioneers, I mean, they didn't have stores and fertilizers and things like that. So I started reading this book and was just fascinated by what I found. And what I realized was that the pioneers were working off the land with what they had. And this was very valuable information. This was very valuable kinds of stuff. However, I got thinking about it too. And as you learn your true American history, the Native Americans were here before the pioneers were. So what were they doing that held them for centuries before Western civilization arrived on our corner of the planet? You know, and what kinds of things did they know about what could be eaten, about what medicines there were, about how to do agriculture that we've long forgot because of our obsession with our chemicals that make it so we don't have to know all those other skills? And as I started studying more of that, I started realizing how much value there is in the information of the indigenous people of a place. So from around here, you know, you've got Native Americans of several different tribes, and studying what they did for food, for agriculture, and so forth, is incredibly enlightening. Incredibly enlightening. And, you know, seasons happen in cycles. That's obvious. We know that. But there are cycles within those seasonal cycles that you can notice as patterns. Remember, one of the first principles of permaculture is observation, seeing what's there, seeing what things do. For example, you can look at an area and look at the old elm trees that have been here for 100 years. Watch when those start to bloom. Watch when those first start coming out of dormancy. Watch when they first start losing their leaves. Those are road markers or trail markers for what's happening in the atmosphere, in the climate. These things have more to do with the seasons than the date on the calendar, believe it or not. When you can see the patterns of what's going on in nature and recognize them for what they are, you can learn a lot more about what's going on. People have observed animals and their migration patterns and are able to look at the deer and say it's going to be in early spring. Or they can look at the things that are growing blooming, for example, the perennial plants or trees that are growing and say, okay, now it's time to plant these seeds. You know, now it's time to plant the squash because this is in bloom. That's when you plant it. Because the climate, though not perfect in terms of telling you a forecast of what's coming, it's going to be more accurate than what you'll find simply by following a calendar. And the interesting thing about that is many people will respond to something like that by saying, yeah, but I have these apple trees, Granny Smith apples, and you know, every other year it freezes and they lose their blossoms and so forth. You're looking at the wrong plants. Granny Smith apples are not adapted to your climate. At least their original tree were not. And yes, over time they can adapt within, you know, their own little plant to that region. And apples are very broad in the diversity of their level of adaptability. Yes, and that's why you have the tree still. That's why it can still grow here. That's why you still get apples most years. But if you were to take a crab apple that grew from a crab apple that grew from a crab apple on your property, like maybe the pioneers planted this apple tree and then it grew some new apple trees and that grew some new apple trees, those young trees are much more adapted to your climate than what you will get in something that you buy from the store, which is probably actually a graft from a tree from another part of the country, if not another part of the world. And so the plants that grow natively can tell you more about what's going on than anything that you put on the site. You know, does that include weeds? Absolutely. Absolutely it does. In fact, take a look at your weeds. You may find some fabulous food sources that no one ever pointed out to you as being food. They always said, pick that because it's going to compete with your carrots. Well, what you're picking may actually be better tasting, more sustainable, and better adapted than your carrots. So, you know, notice those things. Learn about the native cultures, the indigenous people of the area where you are. There is more to be learned from the area itself by observation and by what science we know about the things in your local ecosystem, and from the indigenous people of that area than you could probably find in all the books, modern books about your area. Because the modern books are going to say, spray this and then use this. What you're doing is you're bypassing the ecosystem to get results, which is not sustainable. I'm not saying it's a bad thing to use chemicals in some circumstances. I think there is a place for that. Especially in first getting established, trees that will do fine once they get established, things like that. But they're not good indicators, and they're not good information about what's going to really do the best in your area. Okay, let's talk about one more thing before we close up here today. State of the world. Now, we could talk about climate change and the situation of the earth and so forth, the political aspects, and I just have no interest in that. I just don't. What I will say is that what the science shows is that there is climate change taking place. Some will call it a cycle that, you know, is perfectly natural. It's not going to hurt anything, whatever you want to say about it. There are these climate change things happening, whether it's totally natural, man-made, or whatever. You know, I'm not going to get into that right now. But it is causing challenges and difficulties and changes. And the important thing to recognize is that permaculture provides something that other educational aspects of climate change and the global situation, it offers something that other realms don't seem to offer, and that is a positive, proactive approach to, quote-unquote, saving the planet. Okay? You know, and I say proactive and positive because, you know, most of the things, you know, what things do you know of, just off the top of your head, what things do you know of that you should be doing to save the planet? You'll probably think of, well, I should be recycling, I should be not wasting my food, I should be, you know, not, you know, dumping junk into the rivers and so forth. I should, you know, clean up after myself, not litter. All of these are good things, but they are passive things. They are things that slow a descent. They slow a descent to so that you're not hitting the ground as hard or you're not falling as fast. But it does not fix the problem. It may compensate for some of the problem for a time, but it does not fix the problem. And most of the approaches that you hear in politics and all this stuff are finding ways of slowing that descent. And that's great. We need to do that too, certainly. You know, prevent major issues. We certainly should not litter. We certainly should recycle our stuff and so forth. But what permaculture is offering is a way of counteracting it and building a positive. How do we fix the planet and make it better than it is? How do we genuinely not just stop the messing up of our air, but how do we clean up the air? How do we create a positive? How do we make the earth better than when humans found it? Is that even possible? I say absolutely yes, it is, through the practices and ethics and principles of permaculture design. If we were to design the planet in a permaculture sort of way, not only would we save the planet, but it would be better than it ever was before humans ever walked the earth in terms of, you know, the climate and so forth. There's no reason why not. There's no reason why not. We are conscious, thinking, logical thinking beings who can create with our technology incredible things. And I'm not just talking about computers, okay? Computers are an incredible technology, a great way of spreading the knowledge of this stuff. But it's not the only technology. Permaculture is a technology. You know, spirituality is a technology. Anything where we're using our brains to construct something is a technology. We can use our brains to come up with technology to re-terraform the earth into something far more incredible than what it is now. And I'm not talking about genetic modification and genetically modified organisms. There's, you know, we'll get into that someday, but I'm talking about taking the most positive elements of every system on Earth and putting them wherever the more negative systems are in the Earth. Implementing the rules and structures of the good that nature does and put them where nature is struggling. We can, you know, save the world, the energy crisis and so forth. That's why I say it's proactive. It's not something that we sit back and make sure we don't do this and don't do that and don't do this. It's not the kind of thing that says take people off the planet and we save the world. No, what we're saying is educate the world in these ways and we can make the earth amazing. So as far as the state of the world is concerned, yes, we are experiencing some challenges right now, and it will continue to get worse for a time before it gets better. In that time, let's use our brains, this ability that we have to create new technologies, to create a whole new world. And permaculture is the one system that I've found that does that proactively and in a very cool way. So we'll go ahead and finish up our podcast by saying, if you're enjoying this, if you are interested in what's going on in the podcast, please comment or you know, contact the podcast so that I can know what is working for you and what you like to hear more of, and so forth for the podcast. So with that, you've been listening to the Wild Tater Podcast, Permaculture for the Penniless. Again, I'm Charles Hathaway. And again, thank you so much for listening.